Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Mobilities and Methods series. The series is hosted by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. I'm your host, Aliza Arıcan. Today, I'm joined by Colin Hoag, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at Smith College. We will be talking about his book, The Fluvial Imagination, on Lesotho's Water Export Economy, published by the University of California Press in 2022. Thank you very much, Colin, for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
So to begin, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background in anthropology? And maybe by way of these questions, you can also tell us how you conceived of this book.
Sure, thanks. Well, I like the question, partly because the book is really the product of a very long dialogue over the course of a decade or more with a community of people. So this background really matters. People like Sefirisay Pepe, Kabela Satala, Ramazzo Gurampai, Corinne Hoag, Anat Singh, Zachary Capel, Katie Overstreet, Elaine Gann, Pierre Duplessis, Andrew Matthews, Danilyn Rutherford, Jens Christian Svenning. I could go on, right? There's all of these people who have been really important to me along the way and who have really shaped this conversation. So it doesn't appear so directly in the book because my name's on the front, but they've been really important voices. I'll say regarding my background that it's really pretty meandering. Maybe this is true for most people, but I was not an anthropologist forever, that's for sure. When I was an undergraduate, I was an English and Spanish major, and basically because I like languages and I was a poetry nerd. And somehow, for reasons that I am still trying to piece together, I went to the Peace Corps after I graduated, and I was sent to Lesotho because the process is kind of open-ended and there's not a lot of choice in the matter. And so I was assigned to Lesotho, not knowing much about it. And I was really excited to get there. And when I got there and spent these 2.5 years there, I came to all sorts of questions about Lesotho and about inequality across the globe, really. About race and segregation, which is really a significant factor in Southern Africa. And I got also really interested in forms of literature and the language spoken in Lesotho, which is called Sesotho. And in particular, I was sent a book by a relative of mine on Lesotho's oral poetry traditions. It was this fascinating book by a guy named David Copeland, who I would later study with at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. And the book was all about how a very long-standing oral poetry tradition called Ditoko was being reimagined on mining compounds in South Africa because Lesotho had for then been, maybe for about a century, in effect, a labor reserve for South African industry. And so many, many people, I mean, most adult men in Lesotho would spend some portion of their lives working in South Africa on the mines. And many, many women of adult age also would migrate to South Africa to work in, you know, domestic work and other kinds of labor. And then afterward, they would return to Lesotho in retirement, or if there was an injury or something like that, and which was really common on the mines. And so on the mining compounds, these men and women were reformulating this oral poetry tradition in order to theorize really their lives away from home on these mining compounds and working, you know, deep underground in these mines. And it was just so fascinating to me. And the book was filled with all kinds of politics, or gender politics, race politics, economic politics. And so I was really interested that this book that was presented under the banner of anthropology was possible in that field. So I decided that I wanted to go do a doctorate in anthropology, and I wanted to pursue those kinds of questions regarding poetry, and specifically focused on the border that South Africa has with Lesotho, because Lesotho, as many people know, is actually surrounded completely by South Africa with a continuous land border. So it's really unusual as a country. And I ended up going to the University of Witwatersrand, as I mentioned, for a master's degree before enrolling in a doctoral program. And I was really fascinated by living in Johannesburg and met some extraordinary scholars while I was there. And I ended up getting a research assistantship with an institute that was called the Forced Migration Studies Program. Now it's been renamed as the African Center for Migration Studies. And that place is really amazing. And they do all sorts of important work. And they had me working on this project about immigration bureaucracy at the Department of Home Affairs in South Africa, which is a really important and dysfunctional government department there. And so I got really interested in, you know, these questions of bureaucracy, and also like deepened my interest in migration studies. And then I went to University of California, Santa Cruz for my doctorate. And it was a really disorienting experience in a lot of ways, actually, because whereas in Johannesburg at Wits, there was a really different set of literatures that were, you know, seen as really important. And there were a different set of issues that were, you know, in the newspapers, for example, and just being talked about around seminar tables. Whereas in Joburg, they were organized around political philosophy and, you know, questions of sovereignty and things like this, citizenship and identity. At Santa Cruz, questions of the environment were really top of mind, and in a very interesting way. So not your, you know, grandfather's environment. There was Donna Haraway, there was Anna Tsing, there were all of these really extraordinary people doing work on the environment that I just found so compelling, and I could not put it down. And so I came to reconceive this project on Lesotho that was interested in questions of sovereignty and citizenship and identity, actually as an environmental project, because I realized that the project I had imagined doing was actually the project that had already been done by David Copeland in this book that I really liked. You know, I wanted to redo that book. And I think the book should be redone at another time, because there's still, you know, more happening. And that oral poetic form has now been set to music, and it's an entire important music tradition that's all over the place in Lesotho. So that would have been a great project, but the time wasn't quite right. And I saw that actually some of the questions about citizenship and sovereignty were being articulated not through labor migration, actually, but through this water export economy that had been established in the late 1980s, right around the time, actually, that the labor migration economy in Lesotho was actually declining. So that's another story that we can get to later, perhaps. But that's all to say that this project came about as I guess, reconceived it in light of those changing conditions in Lesotho with regard to this water project and its importance to the national economy and to people's sense of themselves in Lesotho, but also because of my shifting conditions, my shifting circumstances now at UC Santa Cruz as opposed to University of the Witwatersrand.
Wow, thanks so much for taking us through these circuitous paths from, you know, poetics to water. And I want to jump into the question of water and get to the core of the book. So your book really draws our attention to water as something that is produced, and you draw our attention to the infrastructures through which water is produced. So for you, what is at stake in staying with production? And why is Lesotho an important site to understand the production of water?
I like this question also. This is really how I thought about water at the end of my project, was that it was something that was produced. So before the project, I guess I had understood large water storage projects. So this includes water transfer schemes, but also hydroelectric projects, as fundamentally about storage. And storage seemed uninteresting to me, right? That there was this kind of dam wall would be built, and then there would accrue a certain amount of water. And then the real political action was downstream. Sure, there were people displaced, and so there was like a kind of a sacrifice, you know, that was made in those upstream areas, but that the real action took place downstream when, you know, a valve would be opened or shut. And partly I was led to that because of the extraordinary work in water studies that had showed me, you know, just how consequential those downstream politics are for how people in urban areas or on farms or whatever gain access to water, and who among them has that access. But in Lesotho, I noticed that this work of storage was actually really interesting, and it was not just about kind of capturing water behind a dam wall, that there was this pulse of activity, kinds of engineering that weren't just about building dam walls. They were actually symbolic engineering, teaching people how to understand that, you know, act of capture and storage. They were social forms of engineering in which people were taught to act well in the upstream catchment to protect those reservoirs. And then there was also, alongside that, ecological engineering, trying to get people to respect the land in the upstream catchment, you know, in quotes. And so it started to feel to me as though the questions about water access within water studies and water provisioning had maybe an urban bias, right? And that when you realize that production happens, like that the water volumes in the reservoir are contingent upon this upstream work, then a whole host of questions, you know, become worth asking. And I suppose I was inspired in this not just by the fact that, you know, because I was interested in Lesotho, and I spent a lot of time in these upstream areas, and lo and behold, you know, couldn't help but see this action, but also because of the fact that the project took place in Lesotho, which has a very particular history in regard to storage and storage infrastructures. So as I alluded to in the first question, Lesotho had for about a century been made to serve as a labor reserve for South African industry. And this was done through a variety of means, but they are analogous to the production of what were called Bantustans or homelands during the apartheid years in South Africa. And according to that system, rural areas were established for ethnic groups within South Africa, African ethnic groups within South Africa. So the idea, according to this white supremacist political philosophy of apartheid, was that each ethnic identity would have its own homeland. And in that homeland, which was never a nice piece of territory, right? It was these really hard scrabble areas in the, you know, least productive arable, you know, non-arable lands of South Africa. In those homelands, these ethnic groups would have some kind of sovereignty and autonomy, and they would be able to preserve their language and their cultural traditions, and they wouldn't be subject to this kind of melting pot that was Johannesburg, right, in which everybody would be forced to adopt the ways of others. This is how the logic of apartheid, as it was, operated. And of course, it was a ruse, because the real truth to that system was that it was a form of racial capitalism, which is that it was leveraging racial identities for the sake of creating a labor force that was first of all immiserated and could be tapped at any moment. So flows of labor from labor reserves, these homelands, could be tapped, and you know, the flows could be stopped or turned on at any moment. Lesotho was really quite like this. There's a fantastic chapter by James Ferguson in his book Global Shadows that describes just this process. That Lesotho, even though it was a real country, in quotes, and therefore at the dissolution of apartheid was allowed to remain whole, in fact, it has this kind of similar logic within the Southern African political economy. And so Lesotho, before the water economy rendered it as a storage vessel for water commodities, was a storage vessel for labor commodities. And actually the decline of the water, the decline of the labor export economy articulated just perfectly, really, with the rise of the water export economy, because it was right around the end of apartheid, actually, that people from Lesotho lost access in the ways that they had it before to the South African labor market. And it was around that same time that the treaty was signed to move forward with this water export economy. So it's this really interesting kind of symmetry in these two projects. And, you know, in this, all of this business about storage vessels, I was learning from a lot of longstanding scholarship on this racial capitalist system in the region by like Bernard Magubane, Harold Wolpe, and more recently Achille Mbembe too. So they really, I think, paved the way, but they were talking about labor and not about water per se. So my effort was to put some language to describe how the production of water commodities is kind of is analogous to this production of labor commodities, if you will.
Yeah, and I think that's a theme that really comes across in the book. So, you know, we talked a little bit about water as something that's produced. You also show us that water is made to move, and that is done through fluvial imaginations, your book's titular concept. So I was wondering if you can speak a little bit to the relationship between imagination and water's flows and movements. What kinds of imaginations move water, and how does that inform your concept of fluvial imagination?
Yeah, thanks. Well, first, I think this concept came out of a kind of moment of reflexivity, which is that I realized toward the end of this project, as I was writing the book, that I had spent an extremely long amount of time trying to figure out how water flowed across the landscape. It was a very difficult intellectual problem for me. And I realized that it had been at the heart of a lot of the work that I was doing, because we haven't gotten to this yet, but I was working really hard to understand how to read the landscape. So there are fears that soil erosion could compromise this water project, that the sedimentation of these dam reservoirs would render the transfer infrastructure and the hydroelectric infrastructure non-functional, and that therefore measures should be taken to change the way that people graze animals, practice agriculture, and, you know, comport themselves in the upstream catchment. And so I was trying to determine, was this accurate? I mean, what is the state of sedimentation? To what extent is soil erosion a problem? If it's a problem, what's the cause of the problem? What's the history of that problem? Is it a recent thing that soil erosion is now an issue that affects this project? Where exactly is it most pronounced? These kinds of questions. And so I expended an incredible amount of energy trying to come to an understanding about those questions, and the very vexing and difficult questions, even for people who are trained, you know, in fluvial geomorphology and these fields that are typically like tasked with making those determinations. And I saw that actually all of the people that I was speaking to, whether it's the people who were tasked with implementing soil conservation measures in the upstream catchment, or if it was farmers and, you know, livestock owners or herders who were grazing animals in the upstream catchment, they also were trying to figure out how water flows across the landscape and therefore what should be done about it. So it was this realization that actually we all, though from different positions and with different stakes and different histories and sensibilities and tools of seeing, were arriving at this question about how does the water flow exactly and what do you do about it? And so that was really the kernel of the idea for the title, and really helped to organize my thinking in an important way. It was actually refreshing because it took the burden off of me for having to give the authoritative rendering, right, of who was right and who was wrong. I still try to give the best guess account for that based on all of this voluminous evidence that I, you know, accumulated over the course of this decade-long project to provide a satisfactory answer to that. But along the way, also wanted to communicate that the creation of this water export economy kind of interpolated water theorists. It interpolated a set of fluvial geomorphologists. You know, that we all of us moving through the Lesotho highland catchments found ourselves reflecting on what we knew about water's flow and how to read those flows in the landscape, because there are a variety of ways to arrive at an answer to the question regarding what is the nature of the problem, soil erosion and such. Those can be modeling efforts. So for example, within geomorphology and soil conservation, there is a modeling tool called RUSLE, R-U-S-L-E, which takes a set of parameters about the catchment, you know, including the rainfall regime and the slope and the nature of the soils, and then dumps the information into, you know, a calculator, and out pops a number to describe the erosion hazard of an area and the likely sediment accumulation, you know, of a catchment. There are direct measuring techniques. One can measure rates of the suspended load or the bed load in the stream flow, so in the river itself, and then back calculate according to the nature of the rains and the catchment about what the likely volumes of sediment being accumulated are. One can measure gullies, but all of these really are very difficult, first of all, and they require some really long-term monitoring that was difficult to impossible for me, but also including for these water engineers, right? They require a really robust monitoring effort that has even eluded them. And that's on them, actually. That's their problem. They needed to do more of this. So it shouldn't actually be up to people like me to go, you know, search that stuff out. And the water project actually didn't do enough to get a grip on this problem. Another way to measure it includes bathymetry, so like a sonar kind of survey of a reservoir to determine over time what kinds of sediment levels are accumulating and where within the reservoir. And anyway, so all of these are products of this fluvial imagination, this incitement to fluvial theory. They're all moves that are made when one really cares about how the water is flowing across the landscape. And but in the end, without all of that measuring, we're left with are these kind of ad hoc landscape reading techniques that I really focused on and became somewhat skilled at learning from my interlocutors, which is to make, in effect, natural history observations about what the landscape looks like. So there are a lot of different ways to do it, and I won't go through all of them, they can include things like discerning after a big rain what kinds of sediment one finds tumbling across the roadway, or trying to discern vegetation patterns that might point toward evidence of compaction in the soil from livestock trampling or overgrazing, in quotes, and so on. So in effect, all of us were doing this kind of theory work, and that became therefore central to the way that I wanted to describe this activity of landscape and water theory that was being produced in the upstream catchment, and which I think is really important, not just for Lesotho, notwithstanding the particularities of Lesotho, I think for any number of other water catchments where large water projects like this are in effort, I think you will see the same kind of fluvial imagination being cultivated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm so glad you brought up reading the landscape over and over, because as I was reading the book, I was thinking about, you know, how you invite us to seeing the landscape like a bureaucrat or reading the landscape as one. So I'm curious about what metaphors like seeing or reading do for your thinking around bureaucracy. And maybe they're not even, you know, metaphors for you, but particular methodologies, but I'd love to hear what you think about that and how you work through those.
I like the way you put it, because they are metaphors and methodologies. I mean, I suppose bureaucracy can be thought of as a way of seeing, right? Or a way of disciplining people to see, right? I mean, it's a set of procedures, and it entails paperwork, and it's a set of protocols and whatever else. But at heart, it's a way of seeing the world, I think. And like so many things in our world, our worlds these days, conservation work has a strong bureaucratic ethos and texture to it. So work is done in conservation to isolate and define actors and timelines, and to develop new social or political formations that'll accommodate an intervention into the landscape. And then that intervention will be assessed through bureaucratic means of quantification and whatever else. And so that was really apparent to me in the field as I spoke with people who were implementing these soil conservation programs, that there is a lot of bureaucratic work going on, and that those bureaucratic visions of the landscape at some level get etched into the landscape because they are particular ways of reading the landscape. They're not the only way of reading it, and that they come attached to a political agenda, right? And so their political agenda becomes manifest in a way of doing things in the landscape that reflects that bureaucratic vision. So for example, development and conservation initiatives, which I group together really, because in Lesotho, and I think a lot of places, they are linked. Development initiatives of various kinds, economic development initiatives and conservation initiatives. In Lesotho anyway, they're oftentimes linked through history, and they're very long standing. Lesotho has a really long history of development and conservation work. It's almost a kind of laboratory. It's been made a laboratory for development and conservation initiatives over the past century or more. And these interventions are all over Lesotho. You can see them everywhere, and they are layered upon each other, and they're but in their traces, right? Because as we learned from Jim Ferguson and many other people focused on development initiatives there and elsewhere, many of these initiatives don't take, right? Or if they take, it's sort of ephemerally. And what's left behind is not a fully formed, you know, political formation or something, right? Like it's not an entirely new alignment of politics and society, but nevertheless, things are left behind. There are traces that are left behind. And so in conservation, I've seen this a lot, and I describe in the book how grazing management interventions have been one really signature kind of conservation initiative in Lesotho. And one of the ways that they're put in place is through these range management institutions called grazing associations. And these grazing associations, which are being put into place yet again in Lesotho after, you know, many other tries, are inserted into a landscape littered with these other bureaucratic interventions that have hung around a little bit. And when you see an intervention put in place in Lesotho today, you see how it bumps up against all of these other accreted or sedimented initiatives from the past. And so I saw how not only were these initiatives trying to cultivate a kind of vision of the landscape that they hoped might change the way that people acted within the landscape, but that also they were dead on arrival in a way because of the, not just because of the fact that they weren't at the end of the day necessarily about that conservation initiative in the way that Jim Ferguson described, right? They're oftentimes ways of reaffirming a politics that already exists, but also they were dead on arrival partly because of the prior initiatives that remained salient at some level. So these new initiatives have to kind of reckon with these past initiatives that have some little bit of traction that endures in the social and material landscape, and they have to kind of reckon with it. And so the failure of those past interventions kind of comes to haunt these future interventions, and you know, improvements to the landscape through management become thwarted by prior interventions into the landscape. So it's this really complicated kind of recursive process that I saw being put on full display in the water economy, where these questions really matter a great deal, because the soil erosion problems are real and they really are urgent. And the water engineers and whoever you want to say is responsible for it really need to get a grip on it. But they're kind of hamstrung by this long history of conservation and development from the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And no, I want to continue with another metaphor, or metaphor as method. So you draw from photography and you come up with this term, negative ecologies. So I was wondering if you can elaborate on this term for our listeners, and why was it important for you to think about ecology through negatives?
Thank you for that question. I was really excited about that moment in the book, because it's important to me as an argument about ecology, but also about the nature of the landscape in Lesotho. And it's partly inspired by a concept of shadow ecologies from Peter Dalvern, and also from an insight by Piers Blakey, who is a geographer from a 1985 book actually called Soil Erosion in Developing Countries. And in both cases, the authors point to the fact that a landscape appears fully formed, and yet its formation is a product of things happening offsite. So in the case of Piers Blakey, he describes how soil erosion is often treated as a kind of local problem for conservation initiatives, right? So here in front of us stands this gully, and we must cast about around this zone for responsible actors, and then, you know, get them to change their ways, right? Like, what is happening here that needs to change? When in fact, he showed, because he had a political sensibility about him, has a political sensibility about him, he showed that the action was really off-site, that the reason that people were, say, grazing animals in the way that they are in that landscape is not because of their beliefs necessarily about how to graze animals, although of course that's in the mix, right? But especially it's about the choices that have been limited for them by a broader political economy. So the livelihood, you know, options for people in places like Lesotho's highlands have been severely constrained by a whole host of processes that are not locatable on site. So you have to look off site. I find that so important and valuable for thinking about soil erosion and a host of other problems, actually, but that's another story, that when looking upon an object, a landscape, a phenomenon, a formation, that it is not simply a local product, that actually we have to do some different kinds of scalar work to conceive of what this thing is and how it came about. So that was really important for Lesotho, because Lesotho's erosion problems, I firmly believe, are not a product of on-site management, but rather the kinds of landscape land livelihood options that have been made available through a political economy that has made Lesotho into a periphery, and a periphery that is vital to the center. So the core needs Lesotho for its wealth generation, and so the landscape problems in Lesotho are actually products of the, you know, inequality that's been generated through the production of wealth in the center, in the core of South Africa's political economy, such as in those labor migration mining compounds in and around Johannesburg. And this is So I make the case, for example, that when looking upon a gully in Lesotho, you're not simply seeing a gully, you're actually seeing a kind of a fountain in Sandton. You know, you're seeing a tactical security vehicle or a gated fence, you know, in a wealthy suburb of Johannesburg. That's what that gully is in an important way, or at least you can't understand the gully without seeing the tactical security vehicle. And this, I think, is a really important lesson, not just for like anthropology projects, but actually for ecology. So I did a lot of ecology work as part of this project, which we haven't talked about yet, but that's a whole long story. But the within ecology, there are some scalar problems as well. And oftentimes in ecology projects, the scale of analysis is delimited in a really strong way. And it's important to the methods because of their reliance upon statistical inference and a whole host of other things, but they need a delimited site, and they need for, we need, when practicing ecology, we need a delimited set of actors who can be understood to be acting within this site so that you can understand how, you know, a pattern of vegetation came about, say. And so this is really powerful for that field and its ability to produce, you know, convincing authoritative knowledge about the formation of those patterns. But at the end of the day, it excludes so much. And in, you know, the Anthropocene, you know, in a time of ecological crisis, when people are increasingly aware of the fact that we need to understand environments as both products of non-human action as well as products of human action in politics and culture in particular, I think ecology really strongly needs to have a sense for these kind of politics, right, that are embedded within that scalar work. We need to be able to see the tactical security guard vehicle when doing ecology projects. So that was the origin of that concept. And I really just liked the way that the negative conjured this kind of photographic negative, the sense that there's this, you know, trick to the production of the vision that, you know, has us excluding all that other stuff so we can see it clear and live in color in front of us. And we need to be able to see the negative as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love how, you know, you bring up landscape, which, you know, you really incorporate centrally in your methodology of the book. In fact, you call the book an ethnography of landscape. And I love how you frame these questions about landscape and ecology through color as well, right? So the book really comes across as an ethnography of landscape, not just through how you conducted fieldwork, but through how you wrote the book and the color images that you included. So I'm curious about what this methodological approach meant for you, and what did you want to capture by, you know, writing a book that's an ethnography of landscape?
At some level, that phrase, ethnography of landscape, was a way for describing to myself what I was doing, because of course we also need that as writers and as thinkers, right? We sometimes create concepts just as a way of giving a name to the thing we're doing. So that maybe is the origin. And we do that a lot. A lot of it falls away or gets, you know, shrouded in concepts or something later on that look like they're more directed outward. But this was a case where this one didn't really get shed, partly because I thought that it might be helpful as an outward-facing concept. And I was inspired in it by others who've used similar terms, like Laura Ogden and others. And it was a way for me to capture the fact that this was a project that was really interested in this immersive ethnographic attention to both what is happening and how people are conceiving of it, right? Which I think is like that wonderful movement of ethnography, that it has that reflexive quality to it, even though it's about real things in the world. And but then also it kept the focus on the landscape, which I find is just a really useful concept. I mean, even in that concept landscape, we have both a set of phenomena, a set of objects in motion in a scene. And the scene is beheld, right, by a viewer. And so it captures at one and the same time an array, a spatial arrangement of things that are in movement and have a kind of geometry to them, but also that shift depending on how you look at them. And that was really important for me because I was trying to incorporate not only this ethnographic work to understand the ways that water was moving across the landscape and what it meant for this soil erosion problem and the water export economy, but also trying to incorporate ecological methods, because I really felt strongly and still do that it was important for me to not just name how people were describing the landscape, but also have some way of tracking what I saw in the landscape, whether that was through an ecological science empiricism or through some other means. I needed a way to name that work because it was really important to me. Because at the end of the day, it's not just how people view the landscape, right? Like, there's a lot of important work that happens there that is entirely, you know, that is crucial to understanding, like how, who has access to things in the landscape and how the landscape is understood and manipulated or whatever. But also at the same time, landscapes are products of abiotic and biotic non-human work. And this is a point that was really put for me forcefully, not just by ecology folks that I've talked with and read, but also Zachary Capel, who is an anthropologist who also graduated from UC Santa Cruz, who was with me in my cohort, who is really important to me, is really important to me. And he makes the point really strongly that we have to be able to see the ways that that non-humans are acting within the landscape, and that there's a whole lot of activity in a landscape that has nothing to do with humans. And that's a difficult point to arrive at, actually, especially in all of the, you know, fervor about the Anthropocene, because now we see human traces everywhere, and that's right and wrong, right? I mean, it's right in the sense that there is devastation all around us, but it's wrong in the sense that it maybe puts too blunt a point on it, I guess, if I could say that, that it almost has us imagining the human hand in everything, when in fact, in a plant community, say, there's tons of activity happening, and that we need to be able to see that stuff too. So the concept of ethnography of landscape as a concept and as a methodology was a way of reminding myself and others about all of that movement.
Yeah, that's so beautifully put. And, you know, something that really intrigued me about the book was that it's open access. And I'd love to learn more about what it meant for you to write an open access book, and, you know, whether this reflected in your approach to writing, or even, you know, how you elaborated on the project.
I am so happy that it's open access. I can't communicate it. I mean, I can't overstate that. It's really wonderful. First, because it will be accessible in Lesotho. And I, you know, this is my first book, so I don't really still understand how books work and how distribution and everything works. So I was really nervous that the book might not be on shelves in Lesotho, and that even if it was, you know, books are expensive, especially outside the United States. Books can be very expensive, and that's true in South Africa, in Lesotho, for sure. And so, first of all, it meant that there would be access all over the place, and including especially in Lesotho and South Africa. So that was really important to me. The first thing I should have said was just how thankful I am to UC Press, and in particular, Kate Marshall, my acquisitions editor, for finding these funds, because there was a pot of funds that was available. And I'm so grateful that they were able to find that pot. And one of the wonderful things about it is that when people buy hard copies of the book, which I'm a fan of hard copies, so I do that too, the proceeds from the hard copy book go back into this pool of funds for more open access books, which is really nice. So that was just like a really wonderful bonus for me, I guess. And I really hope that it means that more people will get to read it, and that maybe it can be assigned on syllabi. I know that in my syllabi, I worry about students being able to purchase books, right? So that's hopefully alleviated. And I hope that it will just be more widely read. I mean, we know in scholarly publishing that scholarly books don't make authors money, and they don't really seem to make the publishing houses money either. So I don't know who gets the money, if there is any money being gotten, but this way, more people have access to it, and that's really wonderful.
Yeah, that's amazing. And thanks for taking us through, you know, a book as something that's produced as well, right?
right. I need to go upstream. Yeah.
So lastly, Colin, what is next for you? What are some new research projects or teaching projects that you're working on right now?
Right now I have two different projects going on, both of which I'm really excited about, and neither of which I really have a, you know, strong sense for yet, right? Because they're early, but they're both focused on botany, actually, because I've been really interested in botany these days. And one of them is actually about Sylvia Plath and her time in a botany course at Smith College at our Botanic Gardens Lyman Plant Conservatory. I really like plant conservatories, plant houses. And I have always been a fan of Sylvia Plath, but all the more so lately. And Plath was a student at Smith and one of the most important alums here, and is amazing. And I think raises just a profound set of questions that everybody, I think, should go through to sort through. But anyway, she did, she took a class in botany in her first year at Smith College called Botany 101. And in it, she did a set of experiments in I think it was her second week, called Manufacture of Carbohydrates, where she learned about how plants photosynthesize. And in it, she used bell jars, and it turned out that's where she came upon her bell jar metaphor. And so I am thinking with Sylvia Plath a lot these days, and thinking with her about what plant conservatories are and mean, what the human condition is in light of our encounters with the botanical world, what her encounter there tells us about not just the human condition, but specifically patriarchy and about plant conservatories, because I think they're really interesting. So what it says about encountering plants from faraway places, which is what plant conservatories are all about. They're these colonial artifacts that were sites for the display of colonial exotica from faraway lands, and that used to be really important to colonial plunder, producing cash crops and pharmacopoeias. But nowadays are these kind of relics that we don't necessarily know what to do with, but have these incredible plants. And they are really stirring And I need to understand more about them. So that's one project. And then a second one is focused on the forms of cosmopolitanism, actually, that we see in the cosmopolitan plant family, Asteraceae, sometimes goes by Compositae. So the daisies and the sunflowers. And I'm interested in cosmopolitanism partly because I feel like cosmopolitanism, even though it's a concept we're all familiar with and has been at the center of lots of, you know, in lots of moments of scholarship, including like globalization literatures and whatnot, is really undergoing a strange moment right now with these forms of, you know, white nationalist populisms and other kinds of forms of identity that are rooted in place firmly. So I think that there's something happening with cosmopolitanism that I'm really curious about. But in relation to our understanding of ourselves as humans in the Anthropocene, so in a world that's been disturbed by human action all over the place, and the Compositae, the Asteraceae, are a really good family to think with in that regard, because they are a disturbance-loving plant that has this really profoundly cosmopolitan, you know, global distribution. They occur everywhere, and especially where humans create these open environments. So I want to use them as a way of exploring that concept, but also just to revel and luxuriate in their form and their distribution and their ways of living and their associations and in their ways of movement. I find them really extraordinary. So if anybody out there wants to talk about the Compositae or Sylvia Plath, I hope you'll give me a ring and we can talk.
These both sound fascinating, Colin. We'll be looking forward to these works. But for now, thank you very much for joining us and sharing your book with us.
Alize, thank you so much. This was wonderful. I really appreciate it.
This is your host, Alize Arıcan. This discussion of the Fluvial Imagination on Lesotho's Water Export Economy, published by the University of California Press in 2022, is brought to you by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you for listening.